Morton Stanley was one of the greatest explorers of all time, and throughout his incredible life, which was packed with adventure and conflict. He served as a soldier, a sailor, a journalist, an explorer, an empire builder, a statesman, author, politician, and lecturer. And finally, he was even knighted by Queen Victoria. Stanley is most famous for having found missionary explorer Dr. David Livingstone after he had been out of contact with the outside world for many years. His calm and most understated of comments, having crossed half the continent, Dr. Livingstone, I presume, must be one of the most famous statements in popular memory worldwide. Throughout his life, Henry Morton Stanley experienced brutality, cruelty, starvation, disease, poverty, treachery, betrayal, and ultimately great honor, success, and wealth. Of all the great explorers of Africa, David Livingstone and Henry Morton Stanley stand out head and shoulders above all others. Stanley and Livingstone were very different people, but both of them made spectacular contributions to the development of Africa. And it's impossible to understand the development of Africa without understanding Stanley and Livingstone. Stanley stands out as the only journalist who founded an empire. Although his primary occupation was meant to be recording history, he's most famous for having made history. Stanley stands out as extraordinarily tough and persistent, a model of perseverance. Yet before his 24th birthday, Stanley had a long track record of frustration and failure, defeat and desertion. No one could have predicted how this extraordinary man would rise and develop above all others in his achievements, especially in bringing civilization to what was then called the Dark Continent. The life of Henry Morton Stanley is full of surprises. The first surprise is he wasn't born with the name Henry Morton Stanley, but was baptized John Rowlands. That was believed to be the name of his father. Stanley was born in disgrace, the illegitimate child of 19-year-old Miss Elizabeth Parry. Shortly after his birth, 28th of January, 1841, his mother abandoned him in the hands of her father, Moses Parry, and ran off to London. Economic disaster had reduced this old gentleman to living with his sons in a small cottage and working in a butchery. When John was just 4 years old, his grandfather died. His two uncles were unwilling to care for this illegitimate nephew, so he was taken by the hand, walked to the huge stone building surrounded by massive iron fence. At the door, John was astonished to be seized and dragged inside. The door slammed, and soon he learned that he was now the inmate of St. Asaph's Union Workhouse, an orphanage to confine unwanted children. The workhouse was meant to be John Rowland's home for the next 9 years. No time was wasted on sympathy for the homeless and the unwanted. The life in St. Asaph's was hard and grim. It was described as charity with a vengeance. The rigid routine began at 6 a.m. every morning and continued till 8 p.m. in the evening when they were locked in their Spartan dormitories. In between there was work. The boys swept the ground, scrubbed the floors, worked the fields, shivered in thin, threadbare clothes. The meager meals consisted of bread, gruel, rice and potatoes in very small portions. Saturdays they were scrubbed, and Sundays provided the only relief with two church services and no work. The schoolmaster was ex-miner James Francis, who, having lost his hands in a mining accident, had developed a vicious temper and a callous heart. James Francis apparently took savage pleasure in punching, caning, kicking, whipping, and beating the children entrusted to his care, even for failing to pronounce a word correctly. That was the reason why John Rowlands received his first flogging or whipping. The institution averaged 30 boys at a time, averaging from 5 to 15 years, and the curriculum was described as primitive. John vividly remembers the day when a young 11-year-old boy, Willie Roberts, strikingly handsome, with curly hair and a delicate face, was actually beaten to death. It was rumored that he was the illegitimate child of a nobleman John saw his corpse, his dead body in the dead house. Willie was covered with dark bruises and deep gashes, and everyone was convinced that James Francis had actually murdered Willie Roberts. John recalled that he never missed his mother. He said he was 12 years old before he even learned that every boy must have a mother. Yet even in this unforgiving and depressing environment, John managed to distinguish himself with his drawings, and he managed to draw cathedrals. And these pictures were presented to the bishop and earned him commendation and a Bible from the bishop. John was selected to lead the workhouse boys' choir, and because of his exceptionally good memory, he was pronounced the most advanced pupil in St. Asaph's by the school inspector. One man who later remembered him described John Rowlands as stubborn, self-willed, uncompromising, unusually sensitive, and particularly strong. Now, it's worth noting that David Livingstone was brought up in abject poverty, but he at least had loving parents. Mary Celeste was brought up in even worse poverty and didn't have a loving father. John Rowlands didn't even have a loving mother or father. When John was 15 years old, an event occurred which changed his whole life. Recalling it later, he observed, "But for the stupid and brutal scene that brought it about, I might have eventually been an apprentice at some trade or another, and I would have mildewed in Wales." The sadistic tyrant, James Francis, demanded to know who had scratched a certain table. When nobody confessed, he snatched a cane and he announced he would beat the entire school. As they were commanded to strip, John refused to obey. Schoolmaster Francis erupted in a rage. "How is this? Not ready yet? Strip, sir. I mean this minute. I mean to stop this abominable barefaced lying." "I did not lie, sir. I do not know anything of it." "Silence, sir. Down with your clothes." Never again. John was determined. At that, Francis assailed and beat him mercilessly, lifting him up, throwing him against a bench with such force that he feared his spine had shattered. As Francis laid into him, John aimed a kick into the schoolmaster's face, breaking his glasses, knocking him unconscious as he fell backwards onto the stone floor. As horror swept the school, John fled over a fence to his paternal grandfather, a prosperous Welsh miner and farmer. After hearing his story, he ordered his grandson to leave and never to come back, and his uncles were also hard-hearted. His cousin, Moses Owen, a schoolmaster in Bryanford, gave him some board and lodging, but his Aunt Mary berated the cousin for taking John in. Moses Owen inspired John with his love for books and learning, but the other boys at school were merciless in teasing him and bullying him as an outcast. After 9 months of schooling, he was taken to Liverpool and placed under the care of another aunt, Mary Morris. There he is given a job as a storeman in a haberdashery. After 2 months, he is fired and wandering the streets looking for opportunities of employment. One of these jobs led him to carry provisions to a Captain David Harding of the Windermere ship. The captain spoke kindly to him and offered him a job as a seaman. Once on board and seasick, he learnt that the captain's promise that he might serve as a cabin boy was only a scheme to obtain cheap deckhands and climbing up to the rigging. They often used young children to climb up the rigging to let down the masts and the sails and so on. He experienced further abuse on board ship, and at the first opportunity in New Orleans, he jumped ship. As the sights and sounds of America fascinated John, he met a kind-looking gentleman in front of a store. "Do you want a boy, sir?" The man was startled by his question. The businessman was Henry Herb Stanley, cultured, intelligent, prosperous, happily married, but no children. Although John Rowlands was asking for work, the gentleman began to question him closely. I mean, imagine walking up to him saying, "Do you want a boy?" Well, yes, he did. He determined to adopt John Rowlands. Mr. Stanley took him off for breakfast, followed with a haircut, kitted him out with decent clothes, and employed him as an apprentice to Mr. James Speak, a merchant. So for the first time in his life, John was actually free. He had money in his pocket, room and board, a good job, and he began to add books to the bishop's Bible, which up till then had been his only possession. He then began to construct bookcases in his room out of old packing boxes, and he spent all his free time reading books. This is one thing you see as a theme. Readers make leaders. The beatings and rejection that he had experienced throughout his upbringing had made him something of a social outcast. He's hypersensitive. He's uncertain how to behave in any social context. The first friendship he developed was with Alice Heaton, a runaway girl of 16 years old from Liverpool. She had managed to maintain her disguise as a sailor boy long enough to reach America. When Mrs. Stanley felt ill, John left his job at the store, devoted every minute to the care of his patroness, the only woman who had ever shown him any affection. As Mr. Stanley was out of town on business, John was the only person beside her when she died. Feeling dejected, John obtained temporary employment as an attendant for a sea captain, went up the Mississippi to find Henry Stanley in St. Louis. However, he had already departed. So John then worked on a flatboat or a raft back to New Orleans, where there was all kinds of adventures, avoiding sandbanks, steamboats, storms, dangerous currents, and whirlpools. In New Orleans, John was reunited with Mr. Stanley, and in the first tender action he had ever experienced, was embraced by Mr. Stanley. The next day, Mr. Stanley declared, "As you are wholly unclaimed, without a parent, relation, or sponsor, I promise to take you for my son and to fit you for a mercantile career in future to bear my name, Henry Stanley." This was the beginning of what Stanley later described as the golden period of my life. For the next 2 years, the Welsh boy was educated and mentored by this kind gentleman, provided his first toothbrush, his first nightshirt, his first suits, taught table manners, frequent baths, and intelligent conversation. The young Stanley was expected to read constantly, often aloud, and to discuss what he had read with his father. His father lectured on morality, faith, work, culture, and customs. He taught his son how to think clearly and how to live uprightly. He taught him how to be alert and observant. He would propose hypothetical problems and challenge Henry to suggest the correct solution. Henry Stanley proved to have a remarkable memory, and he soaked up all the teaching offered him. One night in 1860, as they were traveling down the Mississippi River on a steamboat, Henry was on deck when he saw a man enter his father's cabin and threaten him with a knife. Henry leapt at the man, grappled with him, putting the would-be robber and murderer to flight, suffering only a gash in his coat. Business required Stanley now to travel to Cuba. His last words to Henry were to hold fast to Christian principles and be fearless in all manly things. Working in Arkansas, the young Henry was laid low with malaria and fever. About this time, the war between the states erupted, and he received a parcel addressed by a feminine hand containing a petticoat. Stunned by the implication of cowardice, and this is how many women provoked men to join up for the army, volunteer, by suggesting, "You're a coward." He joined the Confederate Army to resist the coming Yankee invasion. In July 1861, Stanley joined other Confederate volunteers in Arkansas as they were issued with flintlock muskets and embarked on a steamboat bound for Little Rock. During his time in Little Rock, he bought a Colt revolver and a Bowie knife. When the day came to march out, the bands were playing, the women were cheering. Stanley was exuberant, he was eagerly looking forward to battle. But soon, with aching shoulders, blistered feet, sweat-soaked body, he began to discard half the implements of the contents of his pack. And he learned the elementary rule of an infantryman: only carry what's absolutely essential. For the first 9 months of his military service, Stanley's regiment marched across Georgia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, and Mississippi. In April 1862, after marching for days in the rain, they arrived at what was to become the bloodiest battlefield in the American War between the states, Shiloh. And that was a colossal battle. Confederate generals Johnson and Beauregard were about to throw 40,000 exhausted troops against 50,000 fresh Union soldiers under General Grant. Most of the Southerners were armed with old flintlock muskets, smoothbore, put the powder down, rammed down the bullet, whereas Northerners had modern breech-loading rifles with cartridges. In other words, they could fire a dozen shots for every one of the Confederates. Serious disadvantage. Soon Stanley's regiment, the 6th Arkansas Regiment, was ordered to march straight towards the Union lines, and the sound of musketry increased in volume and intensity. Artillery shells were soon flying overhead, bringing down branches, debris on the head. Soon there could be nothing in front of them except the enemy. Just enemy filled the screen. The order was given, fixed bayonets at the double quick, and the men in grey gave a great battle cry and surged forwards. As the blue figures began to flee before them, Stanley experienced the exhilaration of victory. He thought the battle was won. Actually, this is just the beginning. Soon they encountered even more Yankees. Volleys of deadly fire tore through the grey ranks. The ground seemed to erupt beneath them. The roar of gunfire, cannon fire was so intense he could barely make out the orders being given. The air was filled with flying metal and the sound of ricochets was all around. It did not seem possible that anybody could survive in the face of such a deadly barrage of lead. The command was given to dive for cover, and Stanley saw many of the men around him mangled, mutilated by bullets and bombs. Then the officers ordered the men to stand up and charge. The Confederates leapt to their feet, and with a great battle cry, they surged forwards. Although pounded by artillery and decimated by rifle fire, the men in grey charged on, sweeping through a second Union regiment. Then Stanley was knocked to the ground, and when he had recovered his breath, he saw his belt buckle was bent and cracked. It had stopped a Union bullet, but he was not injured. Many more charges were ordered, and time and again, the Arkansas volunteers sent the Yankees reeling back in retreat. Then torrential rain fell upon the battlefield. They took stock of their situation, and they realized there were barely 50 men left in their regiment. As another charge was ordered, Stanley found himself isolated and surrounded by Union troops who took him prisoner. Now he is startled by wild-eyed hatred and fury of the Yankees who cursed and threatened to bayonet him. He ended up in a boxcar, shipped to Camp Douglas on the outskirts of Chicago. The camp was a disgusting disease factory, more like a great cattle pen, where wounded and malnourished men were left to die in filth. The prisoners were denied even the most basic of hygiene and medical needs. Fleas, flies, lice, rats infested the filthy barracks. He saw vast numbers of prisoners debilitated, dying of dysentery, typhoid, fever, without the slightest aid from their heartless captors. The commissary, Mr. Shipman, persuaded Stanley to save his life by enlisting in the Union Army. This he did. But 3 days after his release from prison on the 4th of June, 1862, he came down with fever so severe he was discharged for health reasons. He walked to the coast and worked on farms, and on ship he worked bound for Liverpool. He set out to find his mother, who told him she wanted nothing to do with him. Can you imagine? His mother's cold hostility left him in even darker despair than her abandonment of him as a child. Stanley now worked his way back across the ocean to try to find his adoptive father in Cuba. There he is devastated to learn that his father had died 2 years ago in Cuba. Stanley's situation could hardly have been worse. He was homeless, penniless, without friends, without relations, without a home. Afflicted by parasites he had picked up in prison, he didn't even have a country. Stanley determined he would never again consciously seek or expect human affection. Stanley enlisted as a sailor, worked on merchant ships traveling to the West Indies, to Italy and Spain, and he survived a shipwreck off Barcelona. On the 19th of July, 1864, Stanley enlisted in the United States Navy in New York. The Navy records describe him as 5 feet 5 inches in height, with hazel eyes, dark hair, and birthplace England, although he's actually born Wales, but Americans probably can't tell the difference. He served on board the USS North Carolina and the USS Minnesota. As he was given the task of being the ship's writer, he kept the log and wrote reports on land and sea battles, some of which ended up being published in newspapers. His vigorous eyewitness accounts of action and his attention to detail were remarkable. And due to the positive remarks and comments he received and the success of having these reports published, Stanley began to think of becoming a journalist. On the 10th of February, 1865, Stanley deserted the Navy and became a roving reporter in the Wild West. It's remarkable that a man who throughout the rest of his life developed a reputation as being the most persistent and relentless of explorers, the man who never gave up, no matter what, against all odds, in the face of any danger, that before he was 24 years old, Stanley had run away from school, jumped ship, deserted the Confederate cause by changing sides, deserted the United States Navy in a time of war. No one at this stage of his life could have anticipated what he had later accomplished. Failure does not have to be final. He traveled to Missouri, Salt Lake City, Denver, and Omaha. He built a flat-bottom boat which capsized twice. He experienced some of the Indian Wars. Then in July 1866, Stanley set sail for Smyrna in Turkey. There he was betrayed by a treacherous guide into the hands of thieves. He was severely beaten and stole all his money and papers. After being arrested for not having his papers, he wrote an account of the abuse he had experienced in Orient. Then returned to the United States, he joined the expedition into Indian country with General Winfred Hancock. He was impressed at how Hancock negotiated with the Comanche in Iowa, the Kiowa Indians in Nebraska and Kansas. He'd expected to see the Indians severely treated after they had committed so many atrocities against the settlers, like scalping them. Instead, he saw how General Hancock sought peaceful resolutions and negotiations to extend civilization rather than punish the savage Indians. At one point, Stanley met Wild Bill Hickok and interviewed him. When he asked him how many men he had killed, Wild Bill replied he had killed considerably over 100 white men to his certain knowledge. And then he added, "I never killed one man without a good cause." Hickok and Stanley became friends, and when another person made an insulting remark to Stanley, Wild Bill picked the man up and threw him over a billiard table. Stanley reported on General William Sherman's dealings with the Indians in Omaha and Kansas, and reported he learned a great deal how to deal with primitive people from Hancock and Sherman. He noted they dealt with them both as warriors and as children, who must be taught and corrected. And he noted that he learned to do the same when dealing with savage tribes later in Africa, particularly in the Congo. While being the special correspondent of the Missouri Democrat, he also contributed articles to the New York Herald, the New York Times, the Chicago Republican, and the Cincinnati Commercial. Despite frequenting bars and taverns where drunkenness was common, he remained true to his pledge of abstinence, with only one exception which he bitterly repented of. He also lived a very disciplined life, and he saved most of what he earned. Hearing of the upcoming British war with Abyssinia, Stanley persuaded James Gordon Bennett of the New York Herald to hire him as the special correspondent to Africa. Stanley joined the British expeditionary force at the Red Sea port of Zula, Eritrea. King Theodoro had killed the former king and had provoked the kingdom to rebellion through his cruelty and his tyranny. Then he antagonized the British Empire by assaulting their consul Cameron and English missionary Stern. When envoys carried letters of protest from Queen Victoria, Theodora threw the envoys into prison. He just didn't do this to people representing another country. The English diplomats were now tortured and treated in the most horrendous ways, and after unsuccessful attempts to ransom the prisoners, Britain declared war on King Theodora. Not war on Abyssinia, but on the king. In 1869, Britain dispatched an expeditionary force of 12,000 troops of the Indian Army under Sir Robert Napier to secure the release of the hostages and to suitably punish Theodora. Here's some of the photographs of this expedition, and you can imagine the logistics. It was a 400-mile, nearly 600-kilometre march to Theodora's stronghold at Magdala. Stanley rode to the colourful sight of English and Irish regiments of weather-beaten veterans in red coats, colourful regiments of Punjabs, sepoys, Indian cavalry, English sailors with rockets, horse-drawn cavalry, artillery, elephants, camels, horses, mules. What an incredible procession this must have looked like, including loading Gatling guns and cannons on elephants. Elephants from India, that is. On the 9th of April, the Abyssinian expeditionary force arrived at Magdala, the fortress capital of Abyssinia. Apparently undaunted by the impregnable appearance of the stronghold perched on the top of a granite mountain, the British military marched across the river, proceeded up the mountain. Theodora launched 3,500 well-armed warriors down the slopes in a wild charge against the British. Napier ordered the naval brigade to take positions, action front. The naval brigade launched their rockets into the midst of the charging Abyssinians, who were thrown into terror and confusion by these strange weapons. Then 300 men from the 4th were ordered forward, and the command was given, "Commence firing." The British surged forward. The Abyssinians attempted a flanking maneuver, but they were wiped out by the bayonets of the sepoys from India. At the end of the day, 560 Abyssinian dead were counted in the field, but not a single British soldier had been lost, although 32 were wounded. Theodora, now terrified of the British firepower that he had witnessed destroying his best troops the previous day, he attempted to appease the British by releasing all his prisoners. Stanley noted with surprise the lack of emotion expressed by both the captors who had endured years of torment and the liberators also seemed amazingly calm about the whole episode, not the way Americans would behave. The next morning, the British marched up the mountain, began an artillery barrage on the stronghold, followed by an assault, and soon British flags were hoisted on the walls and the bands were playing God Save the Queen. Emperor Theodora shot himself with his pistol, and here you can see the British presenting arms and saluting the dead king that they'd come to punish. Pictures taken of the Abyssinian campaign by Magdala, you see a desolate territory. The British troops look like they haven't washed in a few weeks. And some of the officers, one of the first wars where photographs were used. And commanding officers, Magdala, a really impregnable looking fortress, troops lined up, and this is the kind of territory they had to fight over. And the stronghold of the king, some of the villages in the foreground, and this is where the king's final stronghold was. So, incredibly, no British soldiers died in this final assault either, and 2 days later, Magdala was blown up by the engineers. On 18th of April, 1868, the British Expeditionary Force started back to the coast. And quoting from Stanley, "And thus the modern crusade became numbered with past events to be remembered of all men in all lands amongst the most wonderfully successful campaigns ever conducted in history." That's what the young Stanley wrote. And when he arrived in Suez, he had this story wired to London and then on to the New York Herald. And his was the first news story of the campaign to be published, and it established his reputation worldwide. Stanley was now made a permanent journalist of the New York Herald with a $2,000 salary a year. Stanley's next assignment was to cover the rebellion in Spain. From there, he was tasked to find the great African explorer, David Livingstone. No word had been heard of David Livingstone since he last entered the Dark Continent on what became known as his third missionary journey. Stanley noticed that the thing he hated the most was waiting. "The more tasks I receive, the happier is my life. I want work, so that there will be no time for regrets and vain desires and morbid thoughts. In the interval, books come in handy." Although Stanley loved absorbing knowledge, he admitted that he also had a craze for action. And he observed that his sufferings drove him to prove himself on the pathway to success. Stanley noted that by intense application to duty, by self-denial, he drove himself that I might do my duty thoroughly. Stern duty commands me. Stanley had come through the fires determined to succeed no matter what the odds. He had a tenacious and insatiable desire to succeed. With his quick mind and retentive memory, languages came easily to him. He taught himself French, Swahili, some Arabic, and dozens of African dialects. On the 27th of October, 1869, he received one of the most extraordinary assignments ever entrusted to a newspaper reporter. James Gordon Bennett, Jr. of the New York Herald, commissioned Stanley to go to Central Africa and learn anything and everything he could about Dr. David Livingstone and find him. But first, he tasked Stanley to go and cover the inauguration of the Suez Canal, then to proceed up the Nile to find out about Sir Baker's expedition, then travel to Jerusalem, Constantinople, visit the Crimea, the Korkoids and Baghdad and Persepolis, and then after that go to India, and then go to Zanzibar and from there find Dr. David Livingstone. I mean, has any journalist ever been given an assignment like this? "Draw £1,000 now, and when you've gone through that, draw another 1,000. And when that's spent, draw another. When you've finished that, draw another 1,000, so on. But find Livingstone." Stanley declared that he would go. He would do everything that a human being could possibly do, and beyond that, he would trust in God to enable him to do even more. Stanley immediately that night sent out on his whirlwind tour of the Middle East, covering the opening of the Suez Canal at Port Said, the holy places in Jerusalem. He walked the old battlefields of the Crimean War. He reported on the Russian civilizing missions in Baku. He even had time to scratch his name on the old ruins of the palace in Persepolis where Queen Esther had lived. He went on to India, off to Zanzibar in Africa. And throughout this incredible journey, Stanley read everything he could about Livingstone and other explorers to Africa. He arrived in Zanzibar the 6th of January, 1871. Despite the tremendous discoveries of David Livingstone, the vast interior of the continent was still mostly unknown at this stage. Most of its mountains, lakes, rivers, and forests were still unexplored. Most of the tribes inhabiting the interior of Africa were unknown. Many maps at that time had words like unknown and unexplored territory written across vast sections of the interior of Africa. Stanley immediately saw that slaves and ivory were the primary export of Africa, being brought out of the interior by unscrupulous Arab traders. And slaves and ivory were the enemy that they had to oppose. The Arabs in Zanzibar regarded Africa as a seemingly unlimited supply of slaves and elephant tusks. In June 1856, Richard Burton and John Haddings Speke had set out from Zanzibar to find the source of the Nile. When Burton had fallen sick, Speke set out on his own and he discovered and named Lake Victoria as the source of the Nile. Burton became Speke's bitter enemy and disputed his findings. Therefore, Speke set out with James Grant in 1860 to confirm that Lake Victoria was indeed the source of the Nile. Burton, Speke, Grant, Baker, they'd all established their reputations as great African explorers. But the explorer that surpassed them all was Scottish missionary Dr. David Livingstone. Here you can see Dr. David Livingstone, indicated there, at a debate being organized for Burton and Speke to debate about the source of the Nile. And Livingstone was the chairman of the debate. For over 20 years, David Livingstone had walked across Africa from coast to coast, crossing the Kalahari Desert, discovering Lake Ngami, Victoria Falls, one of the greatest cataracts in the world, Lake Malawi, and many other previously unknown features of the continent. David Livingstone was a tireless crusader against the slave trade. At 52 years old, David Livingstone had left England for the last time, 14th August 1865. Starting from Zanzibar, he proceeded to the mouth of the Rovuma River, and from there he went up to explore Lake Malawi. In December 1866, some deserters from his porters returned to Zanzibar with news that David Livingstone was dead, murdered by Zulu warriors in Malawi. The world mourned his passing, but some doubted the reports. When letters from David Livingstone dated February 1867, July 1868 were brought out of the interior, it created a sensation. Obviously, he had not been murdered, he's still alive. James Gaunded and Bennett now believed that it would be a tremendous news story for his growing newspaper if this famous missionary explorer could be found and interviewed. There's this phenomenal interest in this Livingstone who nobody had heard from in so long. Henry Morton Stanley was only 29 years old when he began the expedition to find Livingstone. He had never before led or organized an expedition, nor had he ever been a leader or an employer of men. Yet his wide reading and his varied experiences and travel all seems to have prepared him for this challenge. He spent over $20,000 on the expedition, including purchasing millions of beads, miles of wine cloth needed for payment and trade to cross tribal territories and to barter for food and other items in the interior. He located six Africans who had served as explorers, Burton, Speke and Grant, including Mabruki and Bombay. Bombay was made captain of the Askaris meaning the soldiers, to protect the expedition. Stanley purchased 20 donkeys, two boats, tents, vast quantities of food, medicine, clothing, arms, and ammunition. The supplies were packed in bales, bags, boxes, each weighing no more than 30 kilograms, which would be about the maximum a person could conveniently carry. As everything had to be carried by porters, as the supplies had to last 2 years, great pains and foresight has to be shown in every aspect of the preparation. 6 tons of material would be needed to be carried into the interior. This is just to pay each chief for crossing their territory and to barter for the food they needed and so on. Ujiji, on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, over 742 miles, it's well over 1,000 kilometres away, was the last location where Livingstone had been heard from, and that was Stanley's first target. Start with the known. Stanley recruited two other white men, 23 Askaris, 157 Pagazis, they're the porters, four chiefs, five additional men with different duties, cook, Arabic, interpreter, total of 192 men. At the beginning, two horses, 27 donkeys. The baggage was incredible. You see the loads. 116 loads to be carried, one shotgun, two carbines, four rifles, eight pistols, 24 flintlock muskets, two swords, two daggers, two axes, 24 hatchets, 24 long knives. At first, the terrain was tough savanna. Climate was hot, humid, temperatures over 128 degrees Fahrenheit, sort of over 40 degrees Celsius. As the rainy seasons came, the rivers swelled, the animals and men bogged down in marsh and mud. Every river crossing required much ingenuity and a lot of hard work. Tsetse flies, mosquitoes, every kind of insect afflicted the men, the animals on the column. In the 13 months of the expedition, Stanley was laid low by fever on 23 occasions. Dysentery, smallpox, malaria, unknown fevers afflicted all on the expedition. The first casualty is one of the white team members, William Farker, who died early in the expedition. Every day presented new problems to be solved. Stanley soon learned that leadership required discipline, organization, morale, motivation, conflict resolution, and a lot of communication. Many of the men contracted as porters deserted, stealing or losing the goods they were carrying. It was a never-ending struggle to keep the column together and to keep them moving forwards. Every tribe demanded tribute for travelers to pass through their territory. Yet, despite the many frustrations and delays, Stanley's column achieved a rapid advance, twice as fast as the column of Burton and Speke. There was a battle at Murrumbo. Most of the men were so frightened they refused to go any further. The other white man on the expedition shore now became demoralized and completely worthless at this stage. Many men deserted the column and mutiny erupted. And here's the gravesite of one of their expedition members, Shaw. Stanley loaded both barrels of a shotgun, adjusted his revolvers for ready action, walked towards the rebellious men who picked up their muskets in a threatening way. Stanley raised the shotgun, aimed it directly at the heads, and commanded them to instantly drop their weapons. When Asmani did not obey, Stanley knocked him to the ground and this way quelled the mutiny. He then required all the men who had remained with him to swear a solemn pledge to remain faithful under his command until they found Livingstone. Now, despite many other troubles and starvation which plagued the expedition, the men remained faithful to this pledge. Then they met a native caravan coming from Ujiji. They spoke about a white man with grey hair who had just arrived at Ujiji. Was he ever at Ujiji before? Yes, but he went away a long time ago. Stanley was overwhelmed with excitement and impatience. He pulled out his new flannel suit, had his Wellington boots polished, his helmet chalked, folded a fresh pungi around it. On the 10th of November, 1871, on the 236th day of his expedition, after having departed from Bagamoyo, Stanley ordered the American flag unfold. And with Asmani leading the expedition with the American flag, Stanley ordered guns fired to announce their arrival. Sort of like sending an SMS or phone call, WhatsApp, in those days. Susie and Chuma, the faithful servants of Livingstone, met him on the path and ran back to inform Dr. Livingstone that a white man with a strange flag was coming to see them. As the only two white men all of Equatoria, from the Zambezi to the Nile, met, Stanley walked deliberately towards the older man, took off his hat and said, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." Stanley replied with a smile, "Yes." He lifted his cap and then Stanley shook hands, declaring, "I thank God, Doctor, that I've been permitted to see you." Livingstone replied, "I feel thankful that I'm here to welcome you." Stanley offered Livingstone a packet of letters from his family and friends at home, expecting him to read them immediately. However, David Livingstone put them to one side and said, "As I've been waiting for years for letters, I've been taught patience. I can wait a bit longer." Now tell me the general news. How's the world getting on? Well, he'd asked the journalist, the right person. Stanley gave him an update on the opening of the Suez Canal. General Grant is now president of the United States. The Pacific Railroad across the United States has been completed. The Spanish Revolution had driven Queen Isabella from the throne. Prussia, what today we know as Germany, had defeated Denmark and France in war. Big surprise. France was meant to be the superpower. The first Atlantic cable, transatlantic cable, has been laid, permitting instant communication between Europe and America. And diamonds have been discovered in South Africa. David Livingstone nodded. I wondered how long it would take. What do you mean? Well, David Livingstone said, I found diamonds around there in my missionary work. Kuruman's not far from Kimberley. He ministered in that whole area. He had seen diamonds, threw them in the bush, said nothing more. Why didn't he sell them? I couldn't do that, he said. If people realized we had diamonds in the area, they would have flooded the area with vice. All the miners coming. We hadn't yet evangelized the people in Botswana yet. The Tswana people were still needing to be discipled. If at this early stage in their development spiritually, all the vices of the miners had poured in there, it would have ruined the people spiritually. And so David Livingstone picked up the diamonds and threw them in a bush and said nothing about them. Why didn't you take them back to Scotland, England, and sell them there? I couldn't do that, he said. People knew where I worked. They would have torn the place apart looking for them. These are the biggest, most valuable diamonds the world's ever seen. Imagine that. David Livingstone was so single-minded, he had found the pearl of great price in the gospel. He wasn't going to be distracted by diamonds. From his side, David Livingstone reported that Henry Morton Stanley had arrived at a most opportune time. Arab slave raiders had robbed him of all his supplies. He was desperate, sick, and he was destitute. The friendship which began so formally grew and deepened over the next 4 months, and they were in daily contact. Stanley later reported that he was surprised and captivated by the courtesy, the dignity, the patience, and the high morals of Dr. David Livingstone. Writing of Livingstone late in life, Stanley noted, "Lowly of spirit, meek in speech, merciful in heart, pure in mind, peaceful in act, during health or sickness, he was consistently noble, upright, pious, manly, in all the days of my companionship with him." Livingstone's patience and perseverance impressed Stanley the most. Stanley felt convicted of the fact that up until then, he had tended to solve his problems by running away from them. I think that's what the principal was talking about today, giving up, running away. However, this time, Stanley had succeeded in facing his difficulties boldly and overcoming them. Stanley determined to never again run away from anything. Together, Stanley and Livingstone undertook an expedition by boat around the northern end of Lake Tanganyika. And finally, when Stanley had to return, Livingstone entrusted him with a box filled with his letters, diaries, scientific and geographic research, and many other papers. And on 14th of March, 1872, they parted. Which must have been hard, because Livingstone was like the father that Stanley had never had. After resupplying Livingstone with all of the trading goods he could need, Stanley's column had much less to transport back to the coast. In fact, he divided everything into two, gave half of his supplies to Livingstone, and went back to the coast. They marched in rain, they trudged in mud up to their knees, they crossed innumerable rivers and streams, and finally on the 6th of May, only 54 days after leaving Tabora, they reached Bagamoyo on the coast. There Stanley met Lieutenant William Henn of the Royal Navy, who was leading the Livingstone Search and Relief Expedition sent out by the Royal Geographic Society. This expedition was abandoned before it even began when they learnt that Stanley had met him and had his diaries. Stanley had walked 2,250 miles in 412 days. That is over 3,000 kilometres by foot. 20 members of the expedition had died during this epic expedition. And here you can see the journey, the dotted on the way there, the straight line on the way back to Bagamoyo and Zanzibar. Stanley was completely unprepared for the responses he would receive in Europe. The Paris Geographic Society condemned him as an imposter, but many French newspapers hailed his achievements in extravagant terms, comparing it to Napoleon's march through the Alps. The people in England responded to Stanley's exploits with intense interest and excitement. The Standard and the Spectator, though, expressed suspicion and misgivings over the genuineness of the report. Is this possible? Some claimed that Stanley has never even been to Africa at all. Sensational stories and speculations abounded. The sudden fame, the unexpected suspicions, and the vicious attacks upon his character, and the unfair criticisms of David Livingstone disillusioned Stanley and made him want to recoil even more from society. Stanley wrote that his belief that toil, duty, devotion to duty, righteous living, would receive recognition at the hands of my fellow creatures was shattered. However, when Livingstone's family confirmed beyond question the authenticity of the letters and papers which he had brought back, all charges of forgery were withdrawn, and the Times, the Daily News, and the Daily Telegraph and Punch declared Stanley a true hero. Lord Granville, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, presented Stanley with a gold box with 5 dozen diamonds as a gift from Her Majesty Queen Victoria in recognition of the prudence and zeal displayed by him in opening communication with Dr. Livingstone. I think the people of Britain felt guilty that they had abandoned their missionary and had done nothing to help him for the last 8 years. He left on his last missionary journey without a single person to even see him off at the dockside. And it's like he was yesterday's hero. They didn't care. Stanley was later received by Queen Victoria. He was also honoured by the Royal Geographic Society, presented with the Victoria Medal, offered public apologies for their misconduct towards him. In Scotland, Stanley was awarded another medal and made an honorary citizen. And the completion and publication of Stanley's book, How I Found Livingstone in Central Africa, was achieved only 3 months after his arrival in Europe, and it became an instant bestseller. Stanley now began to receive a flood of letters from strangers, relatives, and acquaintances from his early years who were suddenly affectionate towards this orphan that once spurned or abused. In fact, St. Asaph's Workhouse even put up a statue to him. Sailing into New York, Stanley was received with great fanfare and warm welcome by the entire staff of the Herald. The only person missing from the welcome was the proprietor, James Gordon Bennett Jr., the one who had actually sent Stanley to Africa. The reporter's fame provoked a deep displeasure which developed into jealousy and hatred as Stanley returned from other expeditions and achieved even greater exploits. Bennett's hatred lasted as long as Stanley lived. Sad that some people, instead of rejoicing in the success of another, turned to hatred and jealousy. Receptions, banquets, cheers and applause resounded throughout Stanley's triumphal procession through the United States. Dr. Livingstone's elder brother John came to New York to thank Stanley personally for what he'd done for his brother. Author Mark Twain praised Stanley extravagantly, even comparing him to Christopher Columbus. I mean, Christopher Columbus just had to discover a continent, which is kind of easy if you think how big it is. David Livingstone had to be discovered one person in a continent. When Bennett sent Stanley to cover the war in Spain, he found it a welcome relief from the bound of banquets, lectures, receptions, honours, controversy, and criticism, which had come at him relentlessly since his return from Africa. Then England embarked another expedition to Africa, this time to punish the Ashantis, who had massacred 600 British citizens. Major General Sir Barnet Wolseley was in command of this expedition to what is today Ghana. The year was 1873, and Stanley wrote, "The people are as barbarous, untutored, and superstitious, as wild in appearance, as naked in body, as filthy in the habits as any tribe of savages I've ever seen." Not politically correct terminology. Stanley described the grisly march, encountering human sacrifices and severed heads on poles in every village they passed through. At Kumasi, Stanley located the killing fields of King Kofi of the Asante, a sacred grove where prisoners and slaves had been sacrificed. The terrible stench of decomposing corpses was overwhelming. 30 or more decapitated bodies in the last stage of decomposition were immediately visible. Skulls were piled high, and Stanley calculated the grove contained the skulls of over 120,000 people murdered by the king. The British army fought 3 battles against the Ashanti, but while nothing in Stanley's account of the expedition indicates that he took any personal share in the fighting, Lord Wolseley's memoirs describes Henry Morton Stanley in these words. A thoroughly good man. No noise, no danger ruffled his nerve. He looked as cool and self-possessed as if he had been at target practice. Time after time, as I turned in his direction, I saw him go down to a kneeling position to steady his rifle as he applied the most daring of the enemy with his never-failing aim. The close-shut lips, the determined expression of his manly face, told plainly no danger could appall. The cool, unflinching manliness gave fresh courage. I'd been previously somewhat prejudiced against him as a journalist, but all such feelings were slain and buried at Amofil. Ever since, I've been proud to reckon him amongst the bravest of my brave companions. High praise from General Wolseley, who was a very tough general who had fought in the Anglo-Zulu War, who later was to fight in Sudan, an extraordinary man, and he recognised Stanley as the bravest of the brave. Here you can see the welcome homes, and he published his account of the British military campaigns in Abyssinia and Ashanti in his title Kumasi and Magdala. It was while returning from the Ashanti War that Stanley heard of the death of Dr. David Livingstone. Dear Livingstone, another sacrifice for Africa. His mission, however, must not be allowed to cease. Others must go forward and fill the gap. May I be selected to succeed him in opening Africa to the light of the Christianity. May Livingstone's God be with me. May God direct me as he wills. I can only vow to be obedient and not to slacken. Stanley saw Africa as a challenge, Livingstone as his example and his inspiration. And Stanley dedicated his life to serving Africa by developing Christianity and civilization throughout its vast and unexplored interior. On the 18th of April, 1874, Henry Morton Stanley was one of the pallbearers for the funeral of Dr. David Livingstone at Westminster Abbey. Stanley was given the foremost position on the right and Jacob Wainwright on the left. Shortly after that, the Daily Telegraph of London and the New York Herald united to fund an expedition to Central Africa under the leadership of Henry Morton Stanley to complete the work left unfinished by the lamentable death of David Livingstone, to solve if possible the remaining problems of the geography of Central Africa, to investigate and report upon the haunts of the slave traders. Here at Ujiji, you have the memorial of where Stanley met Livingstone. Under the mango tree which then stood here, Dr. Henry Morton Stanley met David Livingstone 10th of November 1871. This is just the first part of his life. Interestingly, there are people trying to tear down a statue in Denbri, which he's surely the most famous person ever born in that town. There are different sources on this Stanley, this first part of Stanley's life. How I found Livingstone Central Africa is a classic, and it really was incredible how this man came to be linked with David Livingstone. Notice he's born 1841, the same year that Livingstone arrived in Africa. So Livingstone was a senior by quite a number of years. Are there any questions at all on this section of Henry Morton Stanley and his explorations and descriptions of Africa back in the 1870s and 60s. Yes.
Thank you, Doctor. I have a question. You mentioned earlier that he abstained from every other sin except one of which he repented of. So which was that?
No. He never touched alcohol except once, which he regretted, that he drank alcohol and I presume got drunk on the Wild West and really regretted that because he had promised to be temperate for life. So that's what we're talking about.
Oh, okay, I misunderstood it. Then the second one is, why were they considering David Livingstone as an explorer rather instead of calling him a missionary? Where is the distinction there, and what they mean when they consider him as an explorer?
Mm. Well, yes. In fact, you know, when I was at school, I didn't even know that David Livingstone was a missionary. I just thought of him as a great explorer, and it's quite extraordinary that many people today know of Livingstone as an explorer, but they don't know of him as a missionary, and that's quite sad. But David Livingstone was first and foremost a missionary, always. That's his mind. to him his explorations were only a means towards being more effective in missions and evangelism. His exploration was also partly to be able to expose the slave trade and to help people to be able to eradicate the slave trade. So he was first and foremost a missionary, but in the interest of the world that didn't value his missionary work, they were recognizing his exploration and geographic work and his anti-slavery work as very valuable. It's understandable that natural people who are not spiritual cannot understand spiritual matters. They will just focus on what they understand. They didn't understand the missionary work, so they focused on exploration. But to David Livingstone, exploration was only a means to evangelism. Other questions?
So,
yes.
Can we say that he was supported by the government because of his exploration, not the fact that he was ministering, but then he used his exploration to minister the gospel?
Correct. David Livingstone was a London missionary, Saudi missionary, on his first missionary journey. And when he came back to England and he reported on this expedition, published his missionary travels, received by Queen Victoria and so on, he was then made a consul of the British Empire to give him authority to fight slavery. In fact, he even took the British flag, staked it in the ground, this is in Tanzania, drew his sword and pistol and called for people to rally behind him when Arabs were attacking a village, and gave them protection, said, these people are under the protection of the British Crown. You attack them, you attack Britain, and we'll declare war on you. So he used this consul, had a roving consulate position given by the Queen, and a lot of support for the second missionary expedition, the Zambezi expedition. They gave him ships, sailors, all sorts of things. But that expedition was quite frustrating. And virtually every white man on the expedition gave up and left and said, David Livingstone's impossible to keep up with. No one can work with him. He's too hard to work with. His standards are too high and so on. So the second missionary expedition, which was the Zambezi expedition, was considered by many to be a failure. Even though he did a phenomenal amount of exploration, set a lot of slaves free, and Malawi was freed from slavery and made a British protectorate as a direct result of his Zambezi expedition. His third missionary expedition, he got no support whatsoever from the British government. He was supported by the Royal Geographic Society, which is a private group of voluntary supporters, for his third missionary expedition. To particularly, they funded him to go out to find the source of the Nile, which he did not succeed in doing, although he sure tried very hard. But that was left for others to do at another time. Stanley tried to finish his exploration work of Central Africa. So the first time it was only mission support. Second time it was government support for the Zambezi expedition. Third one was just Royal Geographic Society. So he had different sponsors on his three expeditions to Africa, but he always had the same goal. Great commission. Yes.
Yes, thank you. Now, when Livingstone came to Africa, we are told that he had many reasons or objectives, among which was to end slave trade in Africa, to spread Christianity,
yes,
and also to find the Ethiopian roots into Africa. Now,
yes.
His first journey, which he was actually exploring the Zambezi River, the people that sent, I want to see the connection, the people that sent him, David Livingstone, with his team to come to Africa, on their mind, did they really had a mission as to spread Christianity, or did they they were actually sending them so that they can find the roots to Ethiopia, Africa, and find the wealth of Africa?
Mm-hmm.
Because we see the British colony coming at the Cape Colony, and they took over the Boers, and they were in charge, and then we see them coming to trade with African kingdoms that were present during that time and during the Bantu migration as well. Now, I want to know, the people that were sending these missionaries, what is it that they had in mind? Because we see them also giving up on the people they sent. What is it that they really wanted to achieve at the end of the day?
Yes, I mean, that's a good question, and it's hard to always know people's motives at a distance, you know, distance and time. But I don't think there's any doubt that the people supporting the London Missionary Society wanted the Great Commission fulfilled, people saved, bodies healed, churches and mission stations established, schools built, wells dug. That was the goal of London Missionary Society, and I don't think there's any question the London Missionary Society had pure gospel kingdom-building vision. Now, the British government supporting Livingston on his Zambezi expedition, they had other goals. The goal there would have been, the British had just been involved in a disastrous, hideous war, the Crimean War, up in the 1850s, 1854, 1856, and they had totally and completely bungled there. There was a charge of the Light Brigade that wiped out the cream of the British cavalry and a pointless charge against Russian artillery, and it was bad. But there was one good thing came out of the Crimean War, and that's Florence Nightingale, who became a friend of David Livingstone, by the way, too. And they became regular correspondents, but still. So David Livingstone, who also, by the way, when he came back from his expedition, he came back at a perfect time. Britain was in shock at the disasters that they'd just done, the defeats of their soldiers, the blunders of their generals, the chaos of the hospitals. Florence Nightingale's reports that most British soldiers died of neglect from the medical side, not from enemy action. They were dying more of disease in the hospitals than there were bullets and bombs in the battlefield. So the shock in the British psyche was they needed a distraction. And along comes this missionary who's just walked across Africa. David Livingstone doubtless didn't expect such a furor. The Royal Geographic Society would have been excited, of course. But that the Queen received him and he suddenly got nationwide attention. Where did this come from? Politics. They needed the distraction. Here was a heroic man who'd done some great things, and it was to distract the people from the political and military disaster of the Crimean War and the scandals of the British Army being unprepared for giving proper medical care and all the things Florence Nightingale had exposed. So they lifted him up as a great example to distract people from the embarrassing failure of government at that time. Okay. And then there was a lot of rah, rah, Livingstone the greatest, yay, let's end slavery in Africa. And all this was a relief to the government because people forgetting about the fact they just blundered in Crimea, in the Crimean War against Russia, okay? And so they send him off, but now he's yesterday's hero. You know, he helped us through this time. Now he's believing that they're really concerned for freeing people from slavery, bringing civilization to Africa, which some people in the British government are. But most probably, like most politicians are not, there's probably the selfish people and the people think about things. And somewhere along the line say, you know, this is costing a lot and it's a lot of trouble and let's just cancel everything. And at a certain point, he was told, just come back. And all the funding dried up and he was just left high and low. And all of the white co-workers, including his own brother, had deserted him long before his expedition finished. He finished the Zambezi expedition alone. The entire dream team, he had the best of the best the British Empire had to offer, including Thomas Baines, the greatest oil painter of his time. So Livingstone comes back, and nobody welcomes him back from his second great missionary journey. And he's yesterday's hero. He comes back, and it's the first time it was, he's the hero of the century, and the second time he comes back, it's David who? Yesterday's hero, forgotten. So he does his work, speaks in different churches, doubtless to some people interested. The third time he sets out, not a person even goes to the harbour, to the quay to say goodbye. He leaves on his own. Just, can you imagine? And they forget about him for years. And an American saves him at his darkest time. I mean, how embarrassing is that? And so the British were shown to be fickle, went up and down. So you can see, the Royal Geographic Society was interested in geography. London Missionary Society was interested in missions. British government, well, like all governments, they're interested in re-election, popularity in the press, distracting people from real issues. So I'm sure the politicians had devious intentions. But Livingstone, no matter what they wanted to do, he was going to do the right thing. They might be funding him for their own motives, but he was using it to advance the gospel. So I think Livingstone was wise enough to recognize the fact that these politicians are deceitful and unreliable. And they were. So you see the difference. So I'm sure there were people in Britain who their only concern was advance of the gospel, saving of souls, healing of bodies, extending life expectancy. Then there were others who were just thinking of commercial, others were thinking political. You would have had a mixed bag. But there was a very strong core in Britain in the 1800s of anti-slavery, who really were passionately, and this was a sentiment for more than a century in Britain, that their biggest foreign policy goal was to end the slave trade, set the captives free, provide protections to people who have been attacked by slaves. So you've got to recognize this complexity. It's not simple. For example, you can't say everybody came to BBM for the same reason. You can't say everybody becomes a missionary or minister for the same reason. There's many motives. And some people have mixed motives. Some people are here because their parents want them to be. Others are here because of a strong sense of call. There's many different things that could have happened. And so it would be in politics and missions and support. And we've got to recognize that if somebody says everybody had this motive, well, that's nonsense. Because if you say you always or you never, it's a lie, isn't it? There's no such thing as you always and you never. When we say that, we already show we're lying. So when people say they all had this motive, well, I've got no doubt there was many motives at different times of different people. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Any other question?
Thank you very much for that. I see that ending slave trade was paramount for the British government, because when they came at the Cape Colony in 1800, we see them bringing equality between the Bantu people or the Swana that were there with the Boers who had actually taken over the land from them and made them slaves. We see that coming.
Actually, the Boers never made anybody slaves.
Okay.
I mean, where do you get that from? Where did they enslave local people? That never was done. The only slaves in the Cape came from Malaya. They were Muslim slaves from Malaya who were used like the British. The British sent all the criminals from Britain to Australia. If you committed a crime, it could be as simple as stealing a loaf of bread. Transportation, which meant shipped in exile to Australia, not allowed to come back. And so Britain shipped their criminals out of Britain to Australia. The Dutch shipped their troublemakers, terrorists, political rabble-rousers, and criminals from Malaya to the Cape. Because remember, the Dutch ran Malaya as well at the time. And so the slaves that came to the Cape were not local people enslaved. They were foreigners. They were Malays, Muslims, all of them, brought to the Cape as slaves. But they weren't slaves the way you may think. The way the Muslims did, they had their own homes, they had their own families, they had their own mosques, they had their own quarter, the Malay quarter. It's called Boer Kop today. I've done evangelism door to door throughout the Malay quarter. And they went home at night and they had to be at their workplace during the day. They weren't whipped and chained and all this sort of thing, but they were exiled from their land to work there. And this was part of the criminal justice system of the Dutch. So separating the troublemakers, as they called them, some of whom were common criminals, some were political rabble-rousers, who knows, many different reasons, but they came to the Cape. This fiction that the Boers came and enslaved local people is total myth. There is no such case anywhere. And I know that they like to say so in school textbooks, but it's nonsense. The Boers didn't enslave anyone, but they did have slaves from amongst the Malays who came to the Cape, who they wanted to take with them. And the British said no, and they freed them all. So the slavery in the Cape was Malayan Muslim slaves. There never were black African slaves in the Cape, ever.
Thank you, sir. I take that back. So the second missionary journey of the David Livingstone was more centered at navigating the Nile River.
Zambezi. The second was the Zambezi. The third was looking for the source of the Nile.
Okay. So now he was sent to do that.
Yes.
Now I want to know, the British government on his expeditions and also the spread of Christianity and ending slave trade, did they have long-term goals or it was just for a short-term goal?
It definitely changed. So for example, as you saw what I was giving on General Gordon earlier, you had the British government of of Disraeli, who was empire expand, and then you had Gladstone, who was, no, let's pull back and let's retreat and don't get involved in these things. So you had Gladstone, Disraeli. So you had these two parties, from the Conservative to the Liberal Party, going backwards and forwards, and their policies changed. So at one point, you get Gladstone, who's no to empire, we're withdrawing. And then you've got Disraeli, we're expanding. So you had different political parties and prime ministers in Britain who changed the policy. So Britain was not consistent in their policies, which is why they often, someone like Gordon was just left out to dry. If Disraeli had been around in the time of General Gordon being stuck in Khartoum, he would have been happy to send an army because he believed in expanding the empire. Whereas Gladstone wasn't. He is cautious and let's keep them home. There's a lot of money and a lot of loss of life and it's not worth it. So you didn't have all British people united on that. Some were very pro-empire, others were not. But the British Empire in the 19th century was heavily motivated by anti-slavery, ending the slave trade, closing down the slave markets, setting the captives free. And that's where they did a lot of protectorates. And you could say that some of them would have been sincere in that. Others might have been using it as a cover for expanding power and influence or prestige. I'm sure there's always mixed motives. But the British ended up at the end of the 19th century with the biggest empire the world's ever seen. But when you say empire, it's not all empire. Some of it were protectorates, others like Egypt, there weren't even a colony. What was it? It wasn't even a protectorate. The British were just occupying it, letting the Egyptians run themselves, letting the Egyptians run Sudan to a degree, but they were controlling it so that the Suez Canal was kept safe. They didn't even have any long-term goals. They said, we're just here temporarily. So the British Empire wasn't all equal. There was self-governing in Australia, there was self-governing in Canada, somewhat self-governing in South Africa. But when the Boers suddenly had all that gold under them, they found a reason to invade them just for the gold. So you can see very mixed motives amongst the British. Sometimes they were acting really well, and it looked like they were really caring for the good of others. And other times they were acting unbelievably selfishly, like when they stole the Transvaal to get its gold and destroyed all the farms while doing so. Am I answering your question okay?
Yes.
Sorry, not to give you a straight yes answer. It's not a yes or no. It's very complicated. Yeah. Yes.
Yes. The slave trade that was happening in Africa, did it happen between the fellow Africans, that as in selling, exchanging for gunpowder, for ivory, or for gold? Was it among the Africans, or maybe there were other nations that had come to invade Africa?
I understand. The answer is yes, 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 and yes. All of those. The first slave trade that was in Africa was the slave trade of Africans, of other Africans. All African tribes and language groups were involved in slavery. In that, if you committed a crime or offended the chief for whatever reason, you were made a slave. So it was the criminal justice system of the average tribe. So if a person was in trouble, they didn't have prisons. If it's really bad, they had you executed. And if you did something else they didn't like, they made you a slave. And so being a slave was a punishment, like the criminal justice system of many a tribe. You get something out of it. But then with wars, they would often, once you've defeated the enemy, you'd bring the captured enemy and you'd make them your slaves. Okay. Then there were tribes that raided other tribes regularly. The Yao people of Malawi were slave raiders. The Madagascans raided Mozambique. Some Mozambicans raided Malawi. The Malawian Yao raided the Bemba and Chichewa in Zambia area. The Ovambo people in Namibia were raiding the Bushmen and making Bushmen their slaves. In the Congo, the Pygmies were regularly being raided and treated as slaves by the other people. So you had almost every group was involved in some form of slavery, even if it was just the criminal system to deal with criminal justice, or somebody offended the chief. But then you've got the Arabs. Now, the big slave trade was the Muslim-Arab slave trade, where they came and they would either buy from you or they would actually do raids themselves. In some cases, they co-opted the Yao people of Malawi to be their slave raiders. And the Yao would provide them with the vast amounts of slaves that they needed. And the Arabs would be mostly at the coast, but sometimes they ventured inwards. In fact, the Arabs were based even at Ujiji on the Lake Tanganyika. They were raiding into the Congo. So the biggest slave traders of all time were the Arabs. And they still are involved in it to this day, 14 centuries later. And then you had the Europeans got involved in the slave trade back in the, if you go back to, who was the one who got us started? Charles V, the same Charles V that we were talking about last night, the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, who wanted to have Luther killed, the one that Luther stood up to and said, my conscience kept the word of God. It's Charles V of Spain who authorized Europe's involvement in slavery. Now, why? Because Spain had been for 800 years ruled by the Arabs, by the Muslims, by the Moors, actually. The Moroccans, the Moors. So Spain was a colony of the Arabs for 8 centuries before they got their freedom. And so when the Spaniards finally got rid of all the Muslims and they got their freedom, their attitude was, now we're going to get our revenge against the Africans. They enslaved and oppressed us for 8 centuries. Now we're going to enslave them. They'd learned slavery not from the Bible, they learned it from the Arabs. And now they did what was unbiblical and unchristian to kidnap other people. But in doing it, they didn't distinguish between the Africans who were Muslim, who had enslaved them, and the Africans who were not. And the Spaniards didn't seem to get this distinction. And so Spain became the biggest enslaving nation of Europe, followed by Portugal. Now, Portugal had also been under Arabs for centuries. And so they learned very bad habits from them. The Protestants always spoke against slavery. The Catholics generally tend to support it. The biggest slave trading nations of Europe were overwhelmingly Portugal and Spain. Britain got involved in a slave trade by Charles I, the same Charles I who had his head chopped off by Cromwell, Oliver Cromwell, after the English Civil War, tried by Parliament. Cromwell outlawed it. When the Puritan Protestants were overthrown and in came the Catholics again, James I and Charles II, they brought slavery back to England. And then slavery was abolished in the days of William Wilberforce, 1807. And then Britain became the biggest anti-slavery nation. So, Europe's involvement in the slave trade was for 300 years, basically, from 1500 to about 1807. That's 300 years. So Islam's involvement in slavery was 1,400 years, and they haven't stopped. They're still doing it in many places. That's quite an interesting story. Any other questions or comments on that? Yes.
I hear you mentioned that the first missionary to come to the Dark Africa was, if I'm not mistaken, David.
No, I never said he's the first.
Okay. Also, I remember now as we are dealing with this thing, what came in my mind is I need to understand if you know the history about Christopher Columbus.
Yes, sure.
Yes. I hear, so now just confusing, I don't know,
Christopher Columbus was not a missionary, he was an explorer for Spain. He's an Italian, but he was exploring for Spain. So Christopher Columbus was not a missionary.
But I hear when we studied, they said he's the first man who find the man, like the world is second.
No, that's not true either. Christopher Columbus didn't go to prove that the world was round. Everyone knew the world was round. They've known the world was round for centuries. In fact, the Bible speaks, in the oldest book in the Bible, Job, speaks of the Bible of the world being a sphere, a circle, hung in space. So, no, he went believing that you could sail to China by going to the west, which everyone knew. Theoretically, it's possible, but they believed it's too far. The world's too big. There's no way that the ocean is too large. So he didn't go to discover America. Christopher Columbus was sailing west to get to India because he thought the world was a whole lot smaller than it actually is. He miscalculated the circumference of the globe. And just as well, the American continent was in the way because this people would all have died of starvation before they reached China if the American continent wasn't there. He didn't go to discover America. He went there to show that you could trade with China going across the Atlantic. Most people knew, yes, we know if you go west, you can get to China, but it's too far. We can't carry enough food and board our ships to survive to get there. And so it was almost an accident that Christopher Columbus discovered the Americas.